what's going on with the Capitol Police and January 6th? Two little data points jump out at me. The first one is Capitol Hill police officers committing suicide. Now, why would they do that? The left, of course, automatically assumes, without, by the way, a shred of evidence, that these are people who are just emotionally traumatized by the violent sedition of January 6th. And so 6 months later, they're like, okay, that's it. I'm out of here. That's one explanation. But a more plausible explanation, I think, is that some of these Capitol Police officers are pretty conservative. Policemen in general tend to be. And these are people who have been, ever since January 6th, hounded by Pelosi and by the left and by their own leaders for their own reasons to lie, to create a false narrative, to make something of January 6th that it really wasn't, and to destroy the lives of all the people who were involved in January 6th. And so what's happening is that these Capitol Police officers are beginning to feel a pang of conscience. They're beginning to feel, wow, do I want to participate as a police officer dedicated to the upholding the rule of law in this scandalous depredation of law, in this police state operation that that is apparently authorized by the Speaker of the House? Now, what makes me think that we are looking at a kind of police state operation, or let's call it Nancy Pelosi's private militia? Well, I've been very interested in the way that Pelosi has been empowering the Capitol Police and trying to provide funding for them, by the way. There's a bill that's passed the House very narrowly, hasn't passed yet the Senate, to give the Capitol Police all kinds of money and authorization to do things that they previously haven't. Recently, Matt Gaetz made an observation in one of his talks. He said, quote, "What in the heck is the Capitol Police doing setting up an office in Tampa, Florida?" Very good question. Here's the answer for it. The Capitol Police are basically trying to expand their operations nationwide. They're trying to get the idea or promote the idea, this is the leadership in league with Pelosi, that we got to prevent an event like January 6th. And to do that, we've got to monitor extremist behavior across the country. Well, how do we do that? The Capitol Police now are using army surveillance gear to monitor Americans and, quote, "identify emerging threats." Now, wait a minute. Aren't the Capitol Police supposed to protect the Capitol? And don't we have another organization? Ever heard of the Federal Bureau of Investigation that is supposed to monitor threats on a nationwide level? Since when does a local police turn into a national kind of militia empowered to do all kinds of things that it never did before, and as we will see, without oversight? So the Capitol Police now will start using army surveillance equipment to monitor Americans. They're turning the force into, quote, "an intelligence-based protective agency." Intelligence-based. What do they mean? They've taken possession of eight of these so-called, they're called PSSG systems, persistent surveillance systems. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has approved this, and so they're able to do high-definition surveillance. Now, by the way, this is technology that came out of the military. This is technology that was used by the U.S. government in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was used to observe large areas and monitor them day and night, 24 hours a day. So, according to the Capitol Police, this kind of surveillance, which they call, quote, "state-of-the-art surveillance," is intended to, quote, "enhance the ability to detect and monitor threat activity." As if to say, we now need to turn the kind of attention that we've been giving to the Taliban and to ISIS onto fellow Americans. And by the way, the Capitol Police are doing it. Normally, when federal agencies like the FBI undertake this kind of activity, they're part of the executive branch. And so they're subject to freedom of information requests. They're subject to certain types of court oversight to make sure that they are carrying out their functions within the bounds of the law. But here's the difference. The Capitol Police is not bound by any of this. They don't have to respond to FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests. They're not under the same kind of court oversight. Why? Because they are a branch of the legislature. So it's not possible for a court to say you're breaking the law. Why? Because the legislature, which is to say under the supervision of Nancy Pelosi, makes the law. So since the Capitol Police are directly accountable to the legislature, i.e. to the Speaker of the House, I'm quoting here from a report that was put out by Roll Call last summer. It says, quote, Congress is not itself subject to the law, because it is the law, and the Capitol Police as a component of the legislative branch is also exempt from any FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, request. So what you have here is a rogue agency, rogue in the sense that it operates at the behest of Pelosi. It's very clear that all those lying officers that came up there and said, oh, there was a crowd shouting racial slogans at me, a complete made up lie. But these lies were scripted. You could even see one of the officers who basically could hardly read English. He was kind of talking at the fourth grade level, but he was reading these beautifully scripted sentences because obviously they were just put in front of him and they said, basically, read this. So you have a pathetic, embarrassing organization, but nevertheless one that, because of the power that has been given to it by the government and by Pelosi, is also extremely dangerous.
Hello and welcome to The Bookmonger. I'm John J. Miller of National Review. Thanks for listening. This show is a production of National Review, and we're recording from the studio of WRFH, the campus radio station of Hillsdale College. Our guest is Jeffrey Kane, author of The Perfect Police State, an undercover odyssey into China's terrifying surveillance dystopia of the future. Jeff, welcome to The Bookmonger.
Thanks for having me, John. Great to be here.
The prologue to your book, The Perfect Police State, is called The Situation. Why did you choose that title, and what is the situation right now in Western China?
I was in this region of Western China called Xinjiang back in December 2017. I had actually dropped in for kind of an undercover reporting trip. You can go there as a reporter, but you're just going to be followed constantly. So I went there in a more tacit manner on a tourist visa, and I had some guides who were also kind of tacitly helping me just get around the place, understand what was going on. So, by the way, this region of China, it is absolutely apocalyptic. I mean, it is a place where you go and you are surveilled 24/7. There are, cameras everywhere covering pretty much every square inch of the cities. There is artificial intelligence that's monitoring you. There's facial recognition, police pillboxes on, maybe every other corner. I mean, it really is truly a terrible situation. And that's exactly the word, the situation, that two local people used to describe it. I was just sitting down and having tea with them, and they were explaining what was happening in this region of China, and they kept using that phrase. They said, the situation, this is what the situation is. And, they would obviously not say anything critical about the government because you don't know who's listening, but they use these code words just to try to get around the possibility, the strong possibility of being surveilled.
Now, remind us, who are the people of Western China? Who are the Uyghurs? And how did they get on the bad side of China's communist government?
The Uyghurs are a primarily Muslim ethnic minority that live in this region of Western China. They have a history of political independence. They're culturally separate from the dominant group, which is the Han Chinese. And for many years, they have been accused by the Chinese Communist government of being vicious, secret, hidden terrorists who are plotting against the nation to blow it up. So this actually, this struggle has gone back many decades. I mean, it was in the Cold War. There were certainly earlier struggles too. But after 9/11, China began using the language of terrorism and the war on terror to identify this mysterious enemy in the West. So the Uyghurs are actually generally known to be a moderate Muslim group. They are not a group that is known to be, loaded with extremists or anything of that sort. There are terrorists among the Uyghurs, but it is not it is not a group that can simply be identified as harboring these extremist thoughts. So China, throughout the 2000s and the 2010s, sought to control this enemy. There was widespread discontent among the Uyghur community. There were protests. And China responded with a heavy hand, inventing this enemy, doing everything it could to disappear young people, young men in particular, accusing them of leaving to fight with ISIS, all sorts of things. And this campaign over time you know, as technology developed and as new advances happened in artificial intelligence and facial recognition, the Chinese Communist Party decided in this tragedy of errors to roll out what I would consider to be the most sophisticated surveillance state that exists anywhere in the world, and maybe, you know, maybe any time in human history. I mean, that might not be an exaggeration. And I've gone through historical authoritarian regimes like the Soviet Union, and what's happening in Xinjiang just blows this away. So this is the largest internment of ethnic minorities since the Holocaust. There are the upward estimates are that there are about 1.8 million people who are being detained and harbored in a network of hundreds of concentration camps where they're being brainwashed, tortured. I mean, they're having their identities essentially wiped, and they're being transformed into loyal party members. So essentially what we are seeing unraveling here in this region of China, it might really turn out to be one of the greatest humanitarian catastrophes of the 21st century. It's something that has, you know, just in the past few years has been coming to light. There are many witness testimonies, and it is something that the global community, you know, has not quite responded to yet. But, you know, I think that there is momentum growing and that this is going to continue to be a major source of contention in the coming years and decades even.
As you talk, my mind turns to George Orwell and his novel 1984. That must have been on your mind as you were looking into all of this.
Oh, yes, without a doubt. And when I went there for the first time, I was in a town called Kashgar, and I was just thinking to myself, just wandering around. I was detained briefly for taking photographs. I mean, it truly was this George Orwell, you know, this surveillance dystopia that these old science fiction writers had always had nightmares about. They had dreamt them up, and they had written about where technology is going. There's also the Philip K. Dick novella Minority Report, which was turned into the movie by Steven Spielberg with Tom Cruise. The police in this region run a system called the IJOP, the Integrated Joint Operations Platform. The goal of this platform is to gather mass data on every citizen using these novel technological developments in artificial intelligence, in facial recognition technologies, a massive dragnet of cameras, these cameras that cover pretty much every square inch of this region by now. That's what is being reported. And this system scoops up all this data and puts it into a policing system. So it's an artificial intelligence-based system that sends out messages and nudges on the smartphones of police officers there. It tells them, you know, you need to investigate this person because the AI suspects that this individual who we caught leaving work an hour late, there might be something a little off with him. He might be a person who harbors terrorist thoughts and he's planning to attack. So, you know, we should sweep in, investigate, look into the situation, and if it's necessary, detain him and bring him to a concentration camp or a detention course where he'll be, you know, taught the correct way of thinking and, in other words, brainwashed and indoctrinated. So this system, it is just this has led to this massive dragnet of these 1.8 million people who have been taken away into concentration camps. It's just simply that if you do anything that is out of your normal routine, you might be considered suspicious by the Communist Party and by the state. And even if you do things that are in your normal routine, then you might actually also be taken away. So one of my key characters who I had been interviewing for many hours, and I truly just, you know, just I thought she was amazing. I mean, she's this very smart young woman who was a bit of a literary scholar, who loved reading books, was from one of the more affluent families of Kashgar, and who was being groomed to become a diplomat. She had gone to school. She had studied the social sciences in college at a fairly elite university in China. Because she loved reading, because she had traveled overseas, you know, she had also read George Orwell's 1984. She was a big fan of Jane Austen books. She also loved lots of contemporary literature by people like Stephen King and, you know, others such as that. Because of this, she had been taken away. She had been flagged by this system, this AI system, taken away to a camp for a week. And there was all this bureaucratic bungling. She was able to get out because she was intelligent, clever enough to see the flaws in the system, and her family was good at pulling strings. So she was very lucky to get out before the situation, as they called it, got much worse, before more and more people were just put in there for nobody knows how long it'll be. I mean, it could just simply be decades. It could be for life. This book, it's a real life 1984. This is a nonfiction science fiction. It's a nonfiction science fiction dystopia. It is, you know, in the year 2021, what has come to be with the untrammeled development of technology combined with the arbitrary use of extreme state power. And it's truly chilling. I mean, I think I see this book as a warning. It might be prophetic for other countries. I mean, I don't think America is going to ever get this bad, but it's a call to warning to think carefully about how we use technology. What is the role of the big tech corporations in America, and how do we curb their power to ensure that we at least have some kind of democratic process that, you know, that knows how to manage and govern these new technologies as they come out so that they don't adversely affect our society.
The author is Jeffrey Kane. The book is The Perfect Police State, an undercover odyssey into China's terrifying surveillance dystopia of the future. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me, John.
Man, I can't tell you how excited I am that our roads and bridges and infrastructure are finally going to be fixed.
All fixed?
Are going to be.
Finally.
I mean, jeez, we've been paying for this infrastructure. Every president has been like, I got to fix the infrastructure. And we give them the money and then we don't ever hear about the infrastructure, except that we have to do more. So thank goodness that infrastructure bill is a godsend or not. The senior research analyst, Foundation for Government Accountability, Hayden DuBois, is with us now. I asked Hayden to come on because this is 2,700 pages long, and it takes a team to go through it. So what's in it, Hayden?
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Glenn. Well, what's in it is important to recognize that only about 20% of the new funding in this bill goes towards what you and I and millions of Americans think about as traditionally infrastructure. That is, our roads and our bridges.
Is that going to be enough to fix them? Gosh.
I don't know, but what I can say is this, that this is really tied to a larger package of what the Democrats are trying to push through.
Right.
That is nearly $5 trillion in new government spending on expansions of welfare, step towards the new Green New Deal, and other pet projects. I mean, that's really what's at issue here. And we can't excuse some small portion of legitimate infrastructure spending when it's way overbalanced by the priorities of the far left in Congress.
Well, $20 billion goes to Amtrak.
Yeah.
I don't know why we keep bailing Amtrak out, but we do. Amtrak and climate change and related green efforts. What they're trying to do is to try to get us to go to electricity. But I don't understand this. Electricity, it doesn't come from the magic box in the wall. It's most likely made by coal.
Sure. Sure. No, you're absolutely right. They've just got tons and tons of investments in here that they're trying to create a new clean energy office in the Department of Energy, EV charging. They've got a $250 million grant for low emission ferries, which everyone knows is such a big problem. Those, you know, ferries, we really need to do something about it.
Oh, I know. They're horrible.
You dive a little bit deeper into this. I mean, it's 2,700 pages. I tried to read what I could. But case in point example, page 167, it says, and I quote, that they're going to enable and encourage children, including those with disabilities, to walk and bicycle to school, end quote. I mean, that's what they're doing. They're worried about kids' carbon emissions when they're going to school. I mean, what's next? Are they going to put carbon footprint, you know, ankle monitors to make sure these kids are, you know, under the quota of their carbon footprint? I mean, it's just out of control.
Does it say how they're going to do that?
Well, they're trying to create a new program. They're saying it's all about incentivizing, healthy lifestyles and making sure that, you know, kids are getting the physical exercise.
Oh,
but it's really under the guise of part of the climate agenda here that we're talking about.
But how are they going to do that? I mean, even with disabilities, get them to walk to school? Are they going to say, we're not picking anybody up inside of this radius, or what?
Well, I think a lot of it is going to be with pressuring a lot of these areas with grants to, you know, encourage what I think are bad incentives for kids to do. I mean, we see this throughout the bill. I mean, on the topic of energy, they've got another study in there about the effects of closing the Keystone XL pipeline, for example, without restarting any of the construction. We don't need another study. We know the effects of canceling the construction of this. We don't need a government report, another one, telling us that it's a bad idea. I mean, this is what this bill is filled with. It's filled with just, wasteful spending on things we already know or things we don't need, instead of prioritizing the roads and bridges and, you know, potholes that Americans really think of when they think about infrastructure.
I was talking to Mike Lee yesterday about this, and he said the one of the problems that he has with it is it takes over a lot of the things that belong to the states and to the local municipalities.
He's absolutely right. Yeah, I listened to that interview, and he made a great point that, you know, while people are going to say, well, it's good because they've got interstate highway funding and that should be done by the feds, there's a lot in here that is like rural surface transportation grants. That shouldn't be coming out of a centrally planned federal office, you know, that's written up by some senators. States could administer that much more efficiently than the federal government can. The entire, you know, precipice and foundation of this bill is that infrastructure spending is best when it's centrally planned, which we know isn't true. And then when you realize and recognize how that's all tied in to the other trillions of dollars of other priorities that are completely unrelated to infrastructure, like expanding welfare and expanding the child care tax credit and all of that, I mean, we're really stretching the definition of infrastructure to a point it's never been at.
There are provisions in there for Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, to where,
yes,
if you sell your cryptocurrency, you'll be called a broker, and then all brokers have to report all activities to the IRS, right?
Yeah, which is Senator Toomey issued a statement on this, actually, and he said it's virtually impossible to implement because you don't have the required information, you know, the 1099s to do that. And a lot of the blockchain companies are saying it's a ridiculous provision because they're doing that to try to raise revenue through this. But they're saying that the revenue estimates are way off. Toomey called this a hastily designed tax on blockchain. He's absolutely right. This is just, you know, stifling yet another, you know, innovation in the cryptocurrency sphere that we don't need and really isn't going to work and isn't going to pay for what this bill tries to
pay for. So they say that it's trying to, you know, help raise the funds to pay for this, et cetera. But I disagree with you. I don't think it is to do that. I think it's to cripple cryptocurrency because they know what they're doing to the U.S. dollar, and they need a DUSD, a digital U.S. dollar.
That very well could be the case because, well, let me put it to you this way. The underlying theme in this conversation that we can't forget about is inflation, right? We did a poll at the Center for Polling Excellence affiliated with FGA. 87% of voters, including a majority of Democrats, are either very or somewhat concerned about inflation. And Glenn, I keep thinking of three numbers, 30, 30, 30, $30 trillion national debt, 30% annualized rate of inflation for producers' goods, and 30 years high of core inflation. This bill and the associated $5 trillion in spending is only going to fuel future inflation. We're going to wind up with the inflationary consequences of this infrastructure bill, where people won't be able to even afford the gas to drive their cars on the roads that this bill is allegedly going to fix.
How fast do you think that, I mean, you know, what's really irritating to me is they're saying they're paying for this with a lot of the COVID emergency money. Remember, yep, when they just started saying, oh, we need this. We need all of this money. And then they never spent it. They knew this, right, was coming in. And so they're moving all of that emergency COVID spending over to pay all of this. When does this money actually, if approved, start to get pushed out into the system?
Well, here's part of the problem with this, and this is really an underlying problem with this bill as it relates to the funding. We don't even know how much that is going to cover the cost. I mean, they have yet to issue a Congressional Budget Office score for this bill. And they're trying to get it read. Well, nobody's going to read it, but try to get it passed and understood and comprehended before Congress goes on summer recess. They don't even know what it costs. I mean, that's preposterous for anyone to expect that the Senate is going to be able to have a legitimate debate on this. And if you look at some of the funding mechanisms you're talking about, I mean, you've got the unused COVID provisions. One of the most egregious ones in my mind is they're trying to book $49 billion in savings by delaying a rule from the Trump administration that would have changed how drugs are paid for by Medicare. Instead of going to insurers, they would have passed prescription savings on to seniors and some of the truly needy. But because they're delaying that rule will essentially be propping up billions of dollars on the spending priorities of the Democrats, you know, which range from low emission ferries to clean energy supply chains on the backs of our Medicare recipients. I can't speak to the Senate, but I don't think that's a good way to fund an infrastructure proposal, especially when you've got these seniors living on fixed incomes when inflation's so high.
So I want to be charitable to people like Mitt Romney, but I have a hard time doing that. Sure. They say that this is just going to make it cheaper on the other end, because if we give them this, then it won't be so bad in the end. But Nancy Pelosi is saying she's not going to pass anything in this bill unless she gets the full boat in the second bill.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what I think folks have to take away from this. This is not a, you know, I hear the number $550 billion infrastructure package. That's not what this is about. This is about a $5 trillion welfare-filled expansion, one of the largest in U.S. history if it gets passed, that Nancy Pelosi and AOC and Joe Biden are attaching at the hip to the infrastructure package. That's what's at issue here. And that's the fundamental problem, is that this is tied to unbelievable increases in spending in all the wrong areas that have nothing to do with infrastructure. The infrastructure package is just the tip of the much bigger iceberg that forms the basis of what we're talking about here.
Trigger warning, I'm Andrew Klavan, and this is The Andrew Klavan Show. I want to start today not by talking about what they, the evildoers, are doing, but talking about us and who we are and who we're going to be in what is obviously a tremendously difficult political moment. Our elites are a bunch of credentialed idiots. They're responding to their failures by blaming us and by heaping us with their radicalism, their bullying, and their oppression. And so I want to talk about us, because I don't want to live my life in misery and rage worrying about these people. There is a famous and hilarious experiment that was performed on capuchin monkeys by a primatologist named Franz Duval. Here's what happened. They took two monkeys who knew each other, and they put them in adjacent cages, and they gave them a task to do, which is they had to hand a researcher a rock. And if they do the task right, they had a little plate of stones, and if they did the task right, they got a piece of cucumber. And they're happy to keep doing this. They did it over and over and over again. Each time they'd give them a rock and each monkey would get a cucumber. But then they changed it up. And one of the monkeys was given a grape, which is a much more tasty and sweet. And here's a video of what happened when the next monkey got a cucumber after his buddy got a grape. This is Franz Duval describing the experiment.
So she gives a rock to us. That's the task. And we give her a piece of cucumber and she eats it. The other one needs to give a rock to us. And that's what she does. And she gets a grape, and she eats it. The other one sees that. She gives a rock to us now, gets again cucumber.
Now, if you're listening and not watching, he throws the cucumber out through the window and he goes, so to speak, ape. He begins pounding on the table. He's furious. He's absolutely furious. And this experiment works with dogs. It works with birds and other animals. They are happy to do the task if they get equal pay for equal work. But if you jam them, if they get treated unfairly, they become furious. Fairness is a basic moral premise. Even animals understand the concept of fairness, which brings to mind, if you've never read C.S. Lewis's wonderful book, Mere Christianity, you should. This is the opening paragraph of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, edited a little for space. He says, everyone has heard people quarreling. Sometimes it sounds funny, and sometimes it sounds merely unpleasant. But however it sounds, I believe we can learn something very important from listening to the kind of things they say. They say things like this: "How'd you like it if anyone did the same to you? That's my seat. I was there first. Leave him alone. He isn't doing you any harm. Why should you shove in first? Give me a bit of your orange. I gave you a bit of mine. Come on. You promised." People say things like that every day, educated people as well as uneducated, and children as well as grown-ups. Now, says C.S. Lewis, what interests me about all these remarks is that the man who makes them is not merely saying that the other man's behavior does not happen to please him. He is appealing to some kind of standard of behavior which he expects the other man to know about. And the other man very seldom replies, "To hell with your standard." Nearly always, he tries to make out that what he's been doing does not really go against the standard, or that if it does, there's some special excuse. I know that some people say the idea of a standard known to all men is unsound because different civilizations and different ages have had quite different moralities, but this is not true. There have been differences between their moralities, but these have never amounted to anything like a total difference. Whenever you find a man who says he does not believe in a real right and wrong, you will find the same man going back on this a moment later. He may break his promise to you, but if you try breaking one to him, he will be complaining it's not fair before you can say Jack Robinson. It seems then that we are forced to believe in a real right and wrong. In other words, something in the moral sense, even of animals, has evolved to recognize an absolute morality, an objective morality that includes fairness and right and wrong. Now, nowadays, and I've read a lot of books by evolutionists, these evolutionary biologists, and some of them say that the evolution of our moral sense is what creates right and wrong. But if that were true, the moral sense would be the only sense that has evolved that sees something that isn't there. The sense of sight evolved so we can see what's there. The sense of hearing evolved so we could hear what's there, and the moral sense evolved so we could tell the good and bad that is there. Now, there's another thing, interesting thing about human beings, okay? And this is true of animals too, a lot of animals. We have an inner life of fear and love and anger and joy, and nobody knows how this happens and no one knows why it happens. There's no evolutionary reason why we should see danger coming and run away. You know, in fear, we could not feel fear. We're just a machine, right? We could be just designed to see, fire coming and run away. But instead, we feel fear, and then we have to decide, given the situation and our values, whether to run. And this is a mystery of science. Nobody knows why we have an inner life, all right? So our reaction to unfairness is anger, just like a man's natural reaction to a pretty girl is desire, just like our natural reaction to danger is fear. But if we choose to live into our fears, right, we become cowards. And if we live into our desires, we become abusive to ourselves and everybody else around us. And if we live into our anger, we become defined by the people who hate us. Because then we're governed by our reactions to them, right? That defines us. So the fact that they are mistreating us becomes the definition of who we are. And then our life is not going to be the life of joy that God wants us to live. And this is why I've said a lot of times, anger is the devil's cocaine, because we feel righteous anger, just like the monkey. He has every right to be angry. But then we begin to mistake the anger for righteousness, and we become addicted to the feeling of righteousness. And that addiction is what is often being fed to you on TV, on cable news, on Twitter, by your friends, by the world in general, sometimes by us here at the Daily Wire. We all do it. We make profit by appealing to the angry monkey inside you, so you will get addicted to your anger and that sense of righteousness that comes with it by telling you what all the evil people are doing, right? Now, right now, the evil people are doing a lot of rotten stuff. We're being treated unfairly and wrongly by the powers that be. And for the first time in my memory, the powers that be are the government, corporations, media, the academy. They're all operating in collusion in an attempt, essentially, whether they know it or not, to end our revolutionary liberty and go back, or progress, as they call it, because they're progressives, they want to progress into the past, where they had a system where the elites ruled, unanswerable to the individual common man. And we're angry. We're angry about it, right? We think our rage is our strength. We think our rage is our strength. But that is not true. And there's a reason we think something wrong, right? We think something incorrect because there is a seductive, powerful evil in the world that's always trying to convince us that what makes us weak and miserable is making us strong. Whether it's anger, hatred, drugs, unfettered sex, pornography, we always indulge in these things because they give us a feeling in the moment that we're strong and free, we can do whatever we want, and then they always end up shriveling our souls. Now, our old friend Uncle Jesus said, who you remember from our last conversation, said he wanted us to feel the joy that was in him. He wanted the joy that was in him to be in us. And a lot of what he said was telling us what he saw and how we could see the same things and experience the joy that he felt so that his joy would be in us. And one of those ways was to love our enemies and forgive them. Let's go back to C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis called loving our enemies and forgiving them our terrible duty. And here's what he said. He said, to mention the subject of forgiveness at all is to be greeted with howls of anger. It is not that people think this is too high and difficult a virtue. It is that they think it is hateful and contemptible. That sort of talk makes them sick, they say. Now, I get emails like that all the time, and they take a certain form. Like, the form is usually, why did you say Trump was wrong about X when the libs are doing Y and Z, which is so much worse? Or how can you say we should live in love and peace when, fill in the blank, something is terrible is happening and we mustn't be complacent? So here are the questions that I ask in response. Think about this for a minute. America, at the time of its founding, was that a great moment of freedom and honor and courage and wisdom when our founders acted brilliantly? Or was it a time of chattel slavery when our founders were holding people slaves and oppressing them? Victorian England, was that a moment of political liberation like there had never been before and scientific advance like there had never been before? Or was it a time of British colonial atrocities? Augustan Rome, when Augustus was emperor of Rome, was that a flowering of Latin culture or was it the death of political freedom with the end of the Republic? 1950s America, the early 1960s, was that a pinnacle of peace and prosperity or was it an era of bigotry and repression? America today, is this a country of greater wealth, health, scientific achievement, and even liberty than the world has ever known? Or is it a time when babies are being torn from their mothers' wombs in the thousands every day, when children are butchered and abused to serve the sexual perversions of adults, and when mighty corporations work in tandem with the government to silence the people and demand philosophical conformity? So obviously what I'm saying is, the world at its very best, even at the moments when the world is at its social best, is always also full of terrible human buffoonery and evil. Always, always. It is always filled with human buffoonery and evil. And in the midst of that buffoonery and evil, each of us, whether she's a mom or an artist, an activist, an Uber driver, an athlete, a garbage man, doesn't matter. Each one of us is a soul at a moment in time being shaped for entry into eternity by how we decide what to do, how to react, and how to behave. If you think it's weakness and surrender to live in love and joy and morality in the midst of all this unfairness and oppression and buffoonery and evil, here's my last historical question. Judea at the time of Christ and after Christ, was it a fractious country being well administered by Rome? Or was it a place where Latin tyrants colluded with local officials to crush the freedom of God's chosen people with idiot regulations and an intrusive police presence and high taxes? Would you have been one of the furious, angry rebels who took on the mightiest empire that ever existed with acts of violence and were then wiped off the face of the earth? Or would you have been one of the fat and happy supporters of the empire, living high off the misery of the ordinary man? Or would you have been one of the followers of Christ, gathered in fellowship and charity and love and tried to become better than the world around them and spoke the truth and lived the truth even when they were crucified, beheaded, and fed to the lions? Who were the weak ones? Who were the strong ones? Who, in the long run, turned the mightiest empire on earth to dust and built the world of the future? And I want to look at what that means for what's happening today.